It was the year of deep geeking.
The year of Feedbackapalooza.
The year we discussed our favorite show.
It was the year without Zima.
The year of great tequila.
The year of puns.
And a year of more interviews.
It was a new chance for fun.
It was the end of the series.
It was the year we made it to Crusade.
The year is 2009. The show, Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
And Jeffrey is off in the desert somewhere with video cameras and camera crew shooting something.
And good on him, too.
One of us has to be working, right?
That's exactly right. Doing something productive with their time. Absolutely. Yeah, talking with him, he wouldn't tell me much about what's going on, if this is what's going on, but he's got some stuff that's he's been working hard at, and things are starting to come to fruition. So we're really happy for him that way.
Yes, we are.
Yep. And I'm happy for us. Every time I listen to our new open, I get giggly.
I actually had fun putting those voice clips together. I did. Just listening, hearing all the different voice clips as, you know, people sent them in was okay. But when I added the music and started to line up the voices, you know, at the with the right timing and the right spacing,
right,
I started to get chills. And I was like, whoa. And then that last final bit, I'm listening to it. I listened to that thing like 6-7 times in a row, just going, wow, that's, dude, I'm pretty good. Not as good as Mike, but wow, better than I was a year ago.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And we'll take a moment just to remind everybody about the contest that we're running.
Yeah, we have a contest to win a copy of the Babylon 5 Chronologies script book.
Yes. But what you have to do is you have to identify every voice in that open, in order, of course, and get that entry in by, what did we say, the, I don't have it in front of me somewhere. What's the deadline?
When did I even put a deadline in there?
I think you did.
I did? Let's take a look. I have to look really quick because I forgot what the deadline is. March 3rd.
March 3rd, okay.
Midnight Pacific time, March 3rd. And then on March 4th, when we do the live feed, when we record the episode on March 4th, that'll go out on March 11th, we will pick a random name out of the electronic hat.
Yep.
From
all the names that got the voices correct.
Correct. And we will, that person will win a copy of the Chronologies book. And you want to send your emails, entries to contest@sliceofsci-fi.com. Yes, that's my other inbox that keeps getting abused over on for the contest entries for Slice. And put Babylon Podcast Chronologies Contest in the subject line so I know what it's for.
Absolutely. And just to let everyone know, these voices have either been on the Babylon Podcast or are on other Farpoint Media shows, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so it's not like you really have to go scrounging too far to get this, I think.
All of the voices can be heard elsewhere in the podosphere. And if you do a little scrounging, you should be able to find out all of them in order. 12 names. We know who they are. We want to see if you can figure out who they are. And if you do, we'll give you a book.
There you go. And come on, everybody should get the last three voices right.
I would hope so. And if they don't get the second voice, they're not listening to the show enough.
There you go. There's hints for you, people. No, it's exciting. And thanks to everybody who generously lent their voices to that crazy cool open.
That is something I am highly, highly proud of. And many, many, many thanks to everybody.
Don't. Oh, I thought you were going to start naming names.
No. To everybody who got their submissions into me pretty quickly so I could put that together.
Yeah. Cool stuff.
Yep.
Hey, I've got the latest from the JMS News group here from the great maker himself. Wanted to share this with all the other listeners, let them know what's going on. You ready?
Yeah.
This is what he writes. He says, back from London and gradually working my way out of jet lag to catch up with writing. As I anticipated, the BAFTA went to In Bruges, and deservedly so. Overall, it was a great experience, and I'm perfectly content with the resolution. One can't expect a home run in one's first kick at the cat, as they say in places where apparently cats aren't terribly popular. I'm on draft 2 of Forbidden Planet, and the process is going well. Very exciting stuff, and I hope I can talk about some of that in more detail soonish. About to make the final touches to World War Z, and with any luck, we can get this thing into pre-production also soonish.
Ooh.
Draft 1 of Lensman is in, now working on draft 2. There have been a couple of previews for Ninja Assassin, and the audience scores have been just terrific. I have a suspicion that this is going to do very well. The pilot script for Last Words has gone into DreamWorks, and they're very, very pleased with the script. So we'll see where this goes. Interestingly, due to all the writing work, I've lately begun to be offered directing gigs, most of it in the SF genre, naturally. Nothing has grabbed me enough yet to want to tackle it, but we'll see what the future holds. A couple of studios have extended the offer for me to write and direct my own stuff, which is pretty cool. My agent has forbidden me to take on any other screenplay assignments until March, April, but some projects have begun to circle Casa Straczynski of late, looking for an open place to land when an opening comes. There's some very cool stuff on the horizon. Signed, JMS.
Now, I just want to know how heavy the rock that I've been under for a while has been that I didn't know he was working on a project called Ninja Assassin.
I know nothing about it.
Somebody has to tell me about this project, because that just sounds like fun. My kind of fun.
Yeah, I just have one thing to say. Just, Straczynski, dispense all the trivial stuff, and just get Lensman done, please.
Uh-uh. World War Z.
No. Yeah, zombies. We got a zillion zombie movies. We need a Lensman movie.
World War Z first.
Nope, Lensman.
No. See, if he does World War Z first, that gives him more time to make Lensman better, so deal
okay,
with it.
Okay, all right. Okay.
Zombies.
Lensman.
Zombies.
Lensman.
Zombies. You want to step Lensman. Outside? Huh?
Yeah, let's step outside.
Yeah, okay. On that note, we're going to take a quick break, and Tim and Mike are going to arm wrestle over space opera and zombies.
I will give you such a pinch.
On the next Babylon 5, target Earth Beacon 11629er.
Here it comes!
The moment of truth has arrived.
Let's give him hell.
The final battle for the liberation of planet Earth is on.
Missiles impacting on all sides!
But can Sheridan stop his enemy's final solution for the human race?
Give me ramming speed.
On the next Babylon 5.
Listen to the kick-ass mystic ninjas, or we'll have to get mystic on your ass.
Ho, ha, guard, turn, parry, dodge, feel, ha, thrust.
The kick-ass mystic ninjas can only be found at www.kickassmysticninjas.com.
Digging down into the most obscure facts in fandom, this is
And we are back to talk about probably one of the most anticipated episodes ever in the history of Babylon 5. I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Just the build up, the constant, literally never-ending release of the assault on Clark's forces on Earth. Everything culminates here.
Yes. Yeah, and of course the episode is aptly titled Endgame. I got to tell you, I was shocked to realize that watching this, for some bizarre reason, it is not an episode that I have gone back to very often, and I can't tell you why that might be. Because the intensity of it all the way through is just so high.
So when you think of an episode to just pop in the DVD and rewatch, this isn't in your top 10?
Well, it is now. I can't say that it was prior. Yeah, and again, I'm not sure why that is. I don't know. I really don't have an answer to that. And it's not because I never thought that this was a good episode. It just, for whatever reason, just not there. So I guess the good part of that, I suppose, is that in a sense there were fresh surprises. Sheridan's speech as they show up at Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Now you want to contrast the speech. I hate to dig this zombie horse out of the grave, but Ivanova's speech, compare that to Sheridan's speech.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, his speech is just the intensity of it. This is it. This is what we're here for, boys and girls. We're here to liberate Earth. You know, he directly talks to the people of Earth and to Earth Force. You know, he casts no aspersions. He says, we're here to liberate. We know that there's a lot of you that didn't want to say anything, couldn't say anything. You could say it now.
And I think that's when we realize that not everybody who was against Clark was killed, kidnapped, sent to re-education camps or whatever it was he was doing. They were just afraid to come forward because they would be next on the list.
Right.
And it wasn't until, when was it? It was after the Shadow War, when he lost the support of the Shadows, that he became afraid. And that fear caused him to lash out at everybody around him because he was losing a hold on what he thought he was consolidating. And just the appearance of Sheridan's forces, people saying, okay, we're here now. We're here to support you. Take back what belongs to us.
Yeah, and now it's interesting that you bring up the Shadow connection, because one thing that struck me coming back to it again was the note that Senator Crosby finds that has, of course, the letters circled out that say scorched earth, but the sentence repeated over and over again, the ascension of the ordinary man.
Yeah.
And wasn't it also Cartesia who was looking to burn all of Centauri Prime so that it would be his pyre that lights his ascension into heaven?
Yes.
And here's Clark. He's, you know, you almost wonder if the Shadows promised him more than just the presidency.
They fed into the egos of people near the top of power who they could literally put in power for their own means. But the people they were lifting up, so to speak, were a means to their ends, not necessarily, you know, they're not helping you for you, they're helping you for them.
Right.
What part of that didn't you understand?
Well, that's part of the whole ego and the megalomania. Because one of the things I did notice, I did the freeze frame bit on that note.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, got the scorched earth and the ascension of the ordinary man, but at the top where it's the letterhead, he has underlined president, like it's really, really bold underlined, and then circled earth, like he's holding on to that. I mean, it was such a great little bit of detail. I loved it. I was very impressed with it. But that's that whole thing again, you know, holding on to, even at the last, that dream, that promise.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we, you know, this episode is just crystallized in my mind for the fact that right here, right now, is the best reason ever not to put tactical weapons in orbit around.
Yeah.
Because you never know when somebody else is going to take the remote control out of your hand and do something unplanned with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Protecting who from what exactly? Right. Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. This is the first book, or first episode that has actually driven me to the script book immediately to look up some things. And the one thing that I noticed, the episode was directed by John Copeland. That's those pieces in there with that note, the sequence of Clark scribbling something down, that was all added in by Copeland. There's in the script, it mentions that, you know, they should, you've got Clark in silhouette, picks up the PPG, the mob, the villagers come with the pitchforks and the torches for him. He shoots himself. Senator Crosby finds the note telling Sheridan it says scorched earth. All that Dr. Strangelovian stuff, the sequence of shots showing Clark doing the writing and cutting back and forth. Apparently that was Copeland's addition to the tale.
Nicely done.
I was going to say, I think it really adds a strength and a dramatic tension to the piece.
You know what, the part that echoed for me was when Sheridan's forces are actually attacking the platforms. The whole scene with them coming under fire from the missiles and them firing at the platforms, trying to destroy them before it destroys the fleet and then turns the particle beams on Earth, it's an echo of the chaos that we saw in season one when we saw scenes of the Battle of the Line. Instead of being Earth forces against Minbari forces, you see shots with Earth ships and Minbari ships side by side, fighting to save Earth. And that parallel just it hit me this time. I'm like, whoa, that's a lot more profound than I had not noticed that synergy before.
There was one bit that I don't know how intentional it was, but there's a shot, quick shot in hyperspace. I guess it's early on in the episode, of the Agamemnon, quickly followed by the large Minbari cruiser that Delenn is on. And the first thing that popped into my mind was Delenn's speech. There is only one Earth captain who has survived the battle with Minbari. He is behind me. Well, in this case, now he's in front of her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought it was a neat little, just a little thing in there. Again, I don't know how purposeful that connection might have been, but that was something that I had made. I'm trying to think, there was a couple other connections in there that harken back to earlier episodes, or the theme of sacrifice and loss. This was partly from.
We have two.
I'm sorry, I'm being real scattered. There's a lot going on in this episode. It's hard to kind of corral it in. So,
well, there's a parallel. There's almost a parallel. If you want to look really hard at it and sideways through, like a little bit of smoke in a mirror, there's a parallel between Marcus sacrificing himself for Ivanova,
right,
and Sheridan choosing to sacrifice himself to save Earth. Like one actually is rescued at the last moment, whereas the other one actually commits the sacrifice.
Right. I was thinking more in terms of. You know what? I'm sorry. Okay. Well, it's one of those things. I guess the thing is Jason Carter's performance in this episode is just absolutely superb. His nonverbal work just sends all you need to know. That opening scene where they're looking at Susan lying there in the bed, mm-hmm. and Delenn's trying to talk to him. And he never says anything until she says we have to move her, you know, out of the battle. And that stirs him out of his intense reverie.
Mm-hmm.
But you just look in his eyes, you can see all the pain. And at the end when he finally says what he could never say to her ever while she was alive and could hear it.
Mm-hmm.
That's all running around in his head all the way through the episode, and you can just see it in his face.
Yeah. And I thought the thing about the parallels between his sacrifice and Sheridan's attempted sacrifice was the way it was set up. We see Sheridan make the decision to sacrifice himself to destroy, you know, ram the platform and destroy Earth. And at the last second, someone comes in and stops him or saves him from having to go through with it. And you hear Franklin calling Babylon 5, trying to get somebody on the line to go in and stop. And you wonder, is somebody going to come in there at the last minute and save Marcus? And they don't. And that you're set up to believe that, okay, somebody will get there in time by having somebody come there in time for Sheridan.
Yeah.
And then we get there and it's too late to save Marcus.
Yeah. And it's interesting, in the script book, Straczynski writes that if he had known that Claudia Christian was not going to return, he wouldn't have killed off Marcus.
Yeah. I was upset that Marcus was killed because I thought Marcus was a very interesting foil to everybody.
Yeah, but you know, here's the thing. That's to me is one of the brilliant things about it. And I guess in my mind, part of what makes Babylon 5 work almost in spite of those real world events of actors departing and that sort of thing, to me, that sacrifice that he makes, I mean, he was a great character, don't get me wrong. It's not that I was sad to see him go. But what it did was it drives, you know, obviously with Claudia Christian leaving the show, she was she's not going to be on the show. They decided, you know, this is where it gets into this whole aspect of the real world thing. They figured this is the last season. This is going to wrap up the whole series. Okay, Claudia Christian, as it turns out, leaves. We don't see her again until Sleeping in Light, which, of course, was filmed before her departure. So the whole overall effect becomes this reflection where Marcus, despite being the Brave Ranger, never could overcome whatever fear or block it was that was in him that couldn't tell Susan, I love you. Until he was dying, all right?
Mm-hmm.
By the same token, Ivanova, in reaction to that, basically goes on in exile. Sure, she's off shaking down a warlock cruiser or whatever else, okay? But really, for all intents and purposes, she can't be anywhere near Babylon 5 because the grief is just going to destroy her.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, and the fact that we don't see her again until the very end when Sheridan dies or passes beyond the rim or whatever, I don't know, to me that just makes the whole epic that much more epic and makes the characters that much more real. Because that's what happens. People, you know, in real life, people have things that happen to them, and they go away. You don't see them because something's happened. They just, you know what, I can't be around this town, this city, this group of friends, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And they just disappear. And then 10, 20 years later, they show up. You know, something brings you back together. And mm-hmm. and that's one of those instances where I think that the overall novel that is Babylon 5 is helped by those exigencies of real-world production.
And see, I would want to read some more of JMS's notes, what he had in mind for, or what he might have had in mind for, you know, keeping Marcus. I mean, would Ivanova have died? Would somebody else have used the machine to, like, would they have, you know, several of them tried to use the machine to bring her back? What would have happened? Because if Marcus doesn't die, we don't have anybody major, you know, who's considered a main character, die during this course of battle. And I think that lessens it a little bit. You know, I understand Marcus dying.
Yeah.
If you look all the way back to Ceremonies of Light and Dark, he joined the Rangers to find something to die for, not right. something to live for, to fight for. Right. He was looking for a cause to die for, because that was his way of atoning for what happened to his family, his brother. And so I think him holding on, you know, the grief of the shock, rather, of being about to lose another woman he loved, drove him to search for an extreme measure, which he found.
Yep.
Because Lanier really can't keep a secret as much as he tries.
Well, and I was going to ask you about that. Do you think it was just that Lanier couldn't keep his mouth shut, or do you think he was, he dropped that hint on purpose?
I think that was supposed to be us getting a glimpse of Minbari not being able to lie. He can't evade it, you know.
Right.
You know, there's a truth there that he wants to say, but he doesn't want to give Marcus false hope. There's no way he could have known that Marcus would have left to give his life for Ivana. He could have made that assumption, made that judgment, but there's no way he knew for sure until it happened.
Right. And I did like that he glommed on to the situation immediately when he shows up on the Minbari cruiser and says, Delaney, you sent for me? And she goes, I didn't send for you. Who? And then it was just like, you know, the pieces all fall right into place. I'll agree with you there. Mm-hmm. I'll agree with you.
I really do wonder how it would have turned out, because I think in the original notes for the series Bible, that in season 5, Ivanova was supposed to get involved with Byron.
Yes.
Now, if she and Marcus had a relationship, what would have happened there? Would she have just become fascinated with Byron because, you know, her latent telepathic abilities were drawn to him? What would that have turned into, I wonder?
Well, I understand from what we have to understand that this would be given that Claudia Christian would have remained with the show hence Marcus's departure. What I recall reading was that Ivanova would have been involved with Byron. It would have been yet another example of her not, you know, getting involved in relationships with men that were bad for her, you know, reinforcing the fact that Marcus was the guy. But that would have been it. Because my understanding is it's still Lita who would have organized the resistance that eventually leads to the telepath war.
Right, but she would not have done it because she was involved with Byron. She would have done it because she was fascinated or enthralled by him.
Right, right. And again, yeah. I think the story's stronger because she got that Lita got involved.
Yes, it is.
Byron.
I do agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have some issues with the entire telepath thing, but that's one part that I like.
Well, we'll have to get into that, because
we'll definitely get into it if we get to
Yeah, I know. I'm looking forward to getting into geeking on year 5. That's going to be fun. Let's see, what other aspects are in there? You know, another speech that I really loved was Franklin talking to the NCO about using the telepaths.
Mm-hmm.
Because at first, when she said, oh, you're using them as weapons, and he lays it out, here's, you know, here are the numbers, here's the reason why, they're fighting just the same as us. And at first, it's that kind of almost, you know, it's like you don't understand the tactical situation or the strategic situation, so you don't question it, here's what's going on. But as it keeps going, you really get the sense that it's Franklin almost justifying it to himself, and then it's really, you know, after he winds down, there's just that bit with Garibaldi who understands why Steven exploded the way he did. You know, it wasn't Steven trying to convince the NCO of the justness of their cause and why it makes it okay to do that. It was Franklin trying to justify it to himself.
Mm-hmm. He was still, even at that moment, he was still trying to convince himself that this was right. Because we saw how much trouble he had resolving that with himself after he learned what Sheridan wanted him to do.
Yeah.
And he literally was shell-shocked. He's walking around stunned going, the old Sheridan would never would ask me this.
Right. But he's right, you know, and that was the thing. He Franklin did understand, even though Sheridan, you know, he says the old Sheridan would never have done something like this. The fact of the matter is that in order to win the war, they had to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, again, when Sheridan, or when Franklin starts in on a speech, that's where you think that's where he's coming from until he, you know, until he stops. And again, it was doubly emotional because Garibaldi is so compassionate with Stephen at that moment, too. You know, he turns to him, he's quiet, he puts a hand on his shoulder and says, you know, in so many words, it's going to be okay.
And from a tactical point of view, you cannot disagree with it because Sheridan really doesn't want to kill too many of his own compatriots in Earth Force, even though they're fighting to defend Earth, but even though they're fighting for Clark. So sacrificing 30 telepaths so he doesn't have to kill 30,000 members of Earth Force on those ships.
Yeah.
You know, it was a tough decision, a means to an end, because you know, he doesn't want to send anybody to their deaths if they can avoid it, but if he can get away, you know, obtain his objective with as little loss of life as possible, 30 lives versus 30,000, yeah. You know, you might not like it, but it is the better choice.
And that's, you know, he knows that they're being marched to their death, because how will Lefcourt and his cruisers regain control of their destroyers? They're going to shoot the telepaths.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that. And it's interesting that you brought that up in terms of the numbers and the tactical, because there yet another speech that I really liked in this was Lefcourt's.
Yeah.
As they get ready to go, and he hails the rest of his destroyer group and says, okay, listen up, here's the deal. You know, we're engaging the enemy, don't think of them as friends, as partners, as people you've served alongside. They are targets, plain and simple. What he tells to the captain that he takes over from, and he says, you know, the reason why I've been placed in command instead of you is because I come from the old school. And, you know, I know Sheridan. And the damn thing is, I'm going to have to kill him and everything around him.
Yep. He's not looking forward to it, but he's following his orders. He's following his, you can tell he's actually following his heart. He's defending the oath that he took for Earth Force, even though he's interpreting it a little differently than Sheridan. You know, you wonder, you can tell he kind of feels the same way, because when he saves Sheridan's ship, when he saves the Agamemnon, he says, welcome home, John. No, welcome home.
Yeah.
Would he really have said that if he didn't? You know, he says, I understand why he's doing it, but I could not myself do that.
So something that was pointed out on the Lurker's Guide I thought was interesting is that this was the first captain that we see from the Clark side of things who doesn't use the whole Sheridan's under alien influences thing. That's why we got to stop him. You know, in fact, it's not even, you know, Lefcourt's whole position isn't even an anti-Sheridan position.
Mm-hmm.
His is from that same, like you said, interpreting that code of honor. You know, I'm doing this because it's not my job as a soldier to interpret the orders from the commander-in-chief.
I think that's what makes it so much better.
Yeah.
Because we saw the, you know, we're not giving up because we'll just be killed by aliens, or no, I can't surrender because they're going to hang me for for the orders I follow. This is just, hey, just no bullshit.
Yeah.
He hasn't fallen under the propaganda. He hasn't, you know, fallen, he's not part of the party line,
mm-hmm.
but he is following what he's believing in, just like Sheridan is.
Yeah. And I like Lethcourt too. At first, I'm watching it, and it's like, maybe it's a bit of a wooden performance until all hell starts breaking loose. And then it's like, okay, I get it. He was just showing restraint. He was being the general in charge until things start, you know, coming apart at the seams. What does he tell the captain? Tell engineering that we've just had our shorts tied up over our heads. If they don't get the ship going, I'm coming down there personally. Like, you know, the way he delivered it, it's like, okay, that's going to get them moving. That, you know,
yep.
That will get them working.
Yep, you won't have anybody on the comm saying, I cannot get any more, Captain.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I liked his performance because he was reserved at the beginning, but when his fleet was being taken by surprise, he hopped into command mode and kick-ass command mode.
Yeah. You know,
mode. He's like, okay, we got blindsided. Fix it so we can go after them.
Yeah. Great stuff. And the episode, one of the other things that I know I've commented on in previous Deep Geekings about the CGI and the visual effects, how they're pulling out the stops, but this one, it's like just when you think they couldn't do anything more, they ramped it up beyond belief. You know, the flyover shots of Mars as the White Star is zooming around. You know, just all of it. Of course, all the ships in battle in hyperspace and around Mars and around Earth. But just it was just especially, you know what, I know some of the crew that worked on B5 are working on the new Battlestar Galactica, but those shots of the White Star when it's flying around on Mars with that whole, you know, cinema verite look, the handheld camera thing that zooms in and then finally locks in on the White Star as it's zipping around.
Mm-hmm.
Groundbreaking.
That's the part that I like, where you saw, she's like, they're going to open a jump point in the atmosphere? You can't do that.
Yeah.
And the whole interplay between Franklin and Garibaldi with the longitude, latitude, which one's which?
Right.
but seeing it hop into the atmosphere and start taking out the guns and just going back and forth, making sure all the guns are taken out and all the ground support fighters that could have launched can't. Well, fighters or shuttles. Anyway, making sure that the ground forces could not go anywhere. Yeah, and just flying back and forth, flying cover, making sure nothing takes off to surprise them from behind was fun to watch.
Yeah. Well, there's also the shot that toward the opening of the episode where after they talk with the quartermaster about loading the telepaths on, and so you follow the atmospheric shuttle up to orbit. And it's just this long shot. You know, it's tracking across the base, and then you pick up the shuttle, and it heads through the atmosphere, and the atmosphere gives way to space and the cold stars, and then it kind of turns over, and you're heading toward the fleet, and it's just this beautiful, long shot. Very impressive. It's a great episode. I mean, it's just really from the first frame on, just grabs you and doesn't let go. I mean, there's really no, you know, any lull in the pacing as such isn't a lull. It's just one of those, it's like the little dip in the roller coaster before it plunges you down another 300 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the other little tidbit that I liked, the code signals that they were using. The Seven Dwarfs. Did you really think about who Snow White was?
No.
What that means?
Grumpy was Garibaldi.
Well, Grumpy was Garibaldi. That was odd.
Doc was Doc.
Right?
I thought Lita was Sleepy.
That, possibly. But Snow White was Marcus.
Hmm.
And now think about the story of Snow White.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit of foreshadowing there. And we didn't... Did anybody pick up on it until it was too late?
Interesting. I wonder if that was intentional or not.
Yeah, I don't know.
I have to go do some digging now.
What else? Anything else in this?
We get to see
Jane Novastani.
Yes, she's back from her extended imprisonment, we're assuming.
I'm guessing so. And one of the things that makes that even more poignant, all through this episode, we have all the wonderful Christopher Franken music in the background. This had nothing behind it and just made it all that more emotional. You know, she delivers the speech, and you can tell that she's moved.
Mm-hmm. Just finally being able to tell everybody, yeah, those were the president's elite forces. We were captured, imprisoned, interrogated. Some of us were killed. That hopefully would start to really, really get everybody thinking about just how bad Clark, you know, the lengths Clark went to make sure he and his maintained that, you know, iron grip of power, even though it was power derived from fear.
Yeah.
I like this episode.
I do too. And I think I'm going to be watching it more often in the future.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
I'm glad you have converted. You have seen the ways.
Like I said, I just don't know why it was that it wasn't one that I went back to terribly often. No, it's just, I don't know. I have no explanation for it. So send in your hate mail to BabylonPodcast@gmail.com.
No hate mail. No hate mail.
All right, what else can we say about this?
It's the first time in a while that we've had a chance to take a breather. And we've ended the episode on, there's not a big battle tomorrow. But what's going to happen? So you're anticipating what's going to happen next, but you don't have that heightened sense of, you know, continuous, oh my God, what's going to happen now? It's just, okay, that's resolved.
Right. And you almost are left wondering, you know, what else is there to tell? Which, of course, will eventually lead us to season 5. But that's a whole other story right there.
Yes. I think we've hit just about everything.
I think so, too.
Yep, I can't think of anything else key that we need to talk about.
Yeah, I think we've got all the points, and people know how to get in touch with us to share their thoughts on it and let us know what they thought we missed. So,
all right. In that case, we will take a really quick break and come back to wrap this all up.
Okay.
Let our frequencies carry you away. Survive horrors unimagined and discover wonders unseen. Encounter new worlds, rocket through the depths of space, and delve into realities that exist in dark mirrors of our own. On Variant Frequencies, we cross genres and boundaries to bring listeners a completely different audio experience. Featuring Parsec Award-winning fiction, we deliver a new short story every month and present serialized novels that test the limits of podcast fiction. Find us at www.variantfrequencies.com. Subscribe today.
And I believe we have some more emails to get to, some more listener feedback.
Yeah, we had some emails that didn't quite get through the gate from the Feedbackapalooza last time. So here we go. We'll start. This comes to us from Megan O'Malley. And she writes, as a former psychology A-level student, that's the end of high school, some of the first studies or experiments I learned about were the Milgram study and the Zimbardo prism stimulation that was part of an obedience topic. The Milgram study had one participant with the researcher asking questions to another participant who was actually an actor. If the actor gave a wrong answer, the real participant was to electrocute the actor, which was faked. It supposedly increased his voltage each time. Most of the participants went over the voltage that would kill and were highly stressed and shaken after. The prison stimulation led to an increased aggression and psychological warfare almost of the prison guards to the prisoners. One example, one prisoner is locked in isolation with the other prisoners made to shout, "Prisoner 159 has been a very bad boy," or something to that effect, to get to the isolated prisoner. The experiment was meant to last 2 weeks, but only lasted for 6 days. I'm sure JMS would have studied these experiments as well, and had some points that have appeared at intersections in real time. So there's more intersections in real time interrogation techniques there. David Logan, on a similar note, writes in, he says, "You may want to try wrapping your head around this during the interrogation. What if the Drazi removing his hood was not part of the authorities' script?" And see, David, that was my point the whole time, was that because the Drazi removed his head, his hood, that I thought that Sheridan was either imagining it or hallucinating or something. I don't know.
Hmm.
But Summer, you made a convincing argument that that was just all part of the...
It was part of the mind game, because yeah. By revealing that the executioner was really the Drazi he thought had already been killed, it sort of put the screws to him in showing that he's not, you know, he is alone. There's no one he can turn to for, you know, to bond with, to, you know, give himself any sense that he had some support against his captors. That was to undermine any sense of that he was trying to create.
Yeah. So
that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Hey, you know, I think that's the brilliance of that episode, is that it's open to interpretation that way. All right. We have one more here from Greg in Albany. "Hey, Tim and Summer, I wanted to give you my guess as to what the upcoming books we got teased with might be. Frankly, I'm surprised neither of you suggested this." Of course, Greg is referring to our interview with Jan and Jason
mm-hmm.
from the Scripps team and that tantalizing bit that they dangled out at us. So Greg continues, "I'm surprised neither of you suggested this. Jason said it would answer any remaining questions we have about the B5 canon. Well, with the new movie book, absolutely all of the televised B5 canon has been released, except A Call to Arms, which we now know is coming with Crusade. So the only remaining B5 canon would be the novels. Perhaps they will be releasing the original JMS outlines upon which the Centauri telepathic Technomage trilogies, and possibly Shadow Within and To Dream in the City of Sorrows, were based. That would explain why they can't tell us what authors are involved. If you mentioned Gene Cavellis or J. Gregory Keyes, that would give it away instantly.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? If I'm right, this would be a great opportunity to learn how much of those novels was JMS and how much was the authors."
Interesting. I wonder if they're going to stick with the trilogy. If they do the books, would they stick with the trilogies and the movie novelizations, or would they go into the other ones as well, the ones that currently, I think, are out of print, except for those two?
Well, given that Straczynski, if I recall correctly, has gone on record saying that out of those novelizations, those
first nine,
the first nine, it's only those two, The Shadow Within and To Dream in the City of Sorrows, that we should consider as canon. So my guess is that since this project, the Scripps team project, is ultimately undertaken at the behest of J. Michael Straczynski, that those novels would not be part of it. Okay? But what did Jason said? It was a series of six books and then a series of two? So that doesn't cover
four
trilogies.
Hmm.
Unless, I'm trying to think. I mean, even if you dumped each trilogy into one massive volume, that still leaves you three short.
I'm wondering if one of them's going to be the unpublished River of Souls.
Well, there you go. Well, we should know shortly. They said in March, right?
Yes. Yes. So that we actually should be having surprises on our doorsteps in the next couple weeks.
Yeah.
And what's even worse is we have to leave them sealed until that night.
Should we tell everybody what the agreement is?
Yes.
The agreement, this is the agreement set up from Captain Jacqueline. She says that she is going to send the Babylon Podcast copies of the first volume of this mystery trilogy. But what we have to do is not open them until the show of March 4th, where we're going to open them live. So
we're opening them live, and we're also talking with people who cannot be named who were involved in putting this together, correct?
Right, correct. And these people cannot be named, not because we are told to keep it from you, our loyal listeners. We can't be named because we haven't been told who it is. So it's a mystery all the way around. We have no idea what's going to be going on that night.
Such delicious torture.
No, right? Yeah. Okay. But in the meantime, next week we'll have another interview coming up with Frank Garcia.
Yes, he is.
Writer of the science fiction television series 1990 through 2004.
Actually, there's two books. There's the first, volume one is 1959 to 1989, and volume two is 1990 to 2004, which includes Babylon 5 and Crusade. So we're talking to him about his involvement with the research for Babylon 5. He said he'd also done some articles in a few of the sci-fi mags back in the day for Babylon 5.
So looking forward to that conversation.
Oh yeah. This book is impressive. This is a college level binding.
It's a textbook.
Yeah, it is. It's a college textbook. That's what this is. And I have a feeling that eventually I'm going to go track down a copy of Volume 1.
There we go. Anything else, Summer?
Not that I can think of.
Yeah, I think we pretty much got it all covered for tonight.
Yes, we are done. Don't forget, we have that contest. Go enter it. I know people are out there eagerly doing their research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, we're done. So if you want to join in this fun, come by the website, babylonpodcast.com. Leave some comments for whatever articles you find. We have a forums threads. You can go get in some trouble over there, farpointforums.com. Look for the Babylon Podcast Forum, and please, by all means, add your comments to the 83x9x12 never-ending thread.
It's insane.
It's crazy. If you want to send in your own emails, that email address is babylonpodcast@gmail.com. Or if you want to submit a voicemail message that we'll either get to during these shows or save for the big feedback-a-palooza we have every 4 or 5 episodes. That number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The other great war came upon us all.
And we will see you next time on the other side of the gate.